This recording is a production of Faith Builders. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2013, held at Faith Builders on August 6th through 9.
Now, today, we want to continue to think about this question of, but as a teacher, how do we cultivate love? How do we shape the love of our students? How can we do that? By the way, how many of you have been to St. Paul's Cathedral in London? A couple hands. A number of years ago, our family had the chance to visit there. Now, St. Paul's was built in the late 1600s, and it's in the shape of a cross. And where the two pieces of the cross come together, large, large area, and there's this huge dome over that. It was designed by Sir Christopher Wren, who's known for those kind of domes, same kind of dome that you'd find on the United States Capitol. It's a huge dome. In fact, the top of the dome is over 350 feet high. Now, if you go to St. Paul's, one of the things you can do is you can climb up there. First of all, in your climb, you go up about 270-some steps. Takes you up 100 feet, and you're just at the base of that dome. Now, remember, that dome was covering kind of the main sanctuary area of the church. But at the base of that dome, on the inside, there is a large walkway the whole way around it. And it has that characteristic of some domes that are designed a certain way that's called a whispering gallery, which means that you can be on one side and someone else can be on the other side, and someone else can be halfway in between, and you just talk to the wall, and you can be heard the whole way around there. Even though the diameter of that dome is more than three times the width of this room here. And so there's seven of us in our family. We spread out around there because we weren't completely sure we believed all this. Spread out around, and there was a lot of people there, but we all turned to the wall, and I began to speak into it, and sure enough, we could hear. And then, so that's 100 feet up. And at this point, they let you walk between the inner dome and the outer dome. The inner dome is a shell, and then you have the outer dome, which is what you see from the outside. In between that, they have steps and ladders and so on that take you on up to the top of that. And so you can go up another 300 and some steps, and you come to the top of the inner dome, and they have a little window in the floor. Now, at this point, you're 300 and some feet up, and you can get down on your hands and knees and look down and see the little people walking around on the floor. And then you can walk up a few more steps, 528 steps in all, to the top, and then they take you to the outside. And you can look out just some fantastic views of London at that point. That's called the Golden Gallery up there. Now, one of the things you need to know about me is that I don't like heights. But I love to somehow be up high and looking out and seeing things. So I know those two things kind of work against each other. My children just enjoyed watching the combined terror and joy in their father. I was just kind of glued against the wall. They were out there hanging over the ledge. I was back against the wall, but I wanted to see. How many of you'd like to visit St. Paul's? See, did that story cultivate perhaps a bit of desire, maybe even some love in you? We're going to do session four today rather than session three. And there are reasons for that. Which I'll not go into right now. See, I could have just given you the raw data about St. Paul's Cathedral and told you how high it was and that there's a whispering gallery there and so on. But it doesn't capture the imagination like embedding that information into a story. So we want to think about that today. There is a book called The Sunflower, written by Simon Wiesenthal, that has two parts to it. The first part is Simon's story as a, well, he was incarcerated in during Nazi Germany. He was in a concentration camp. And it's something of his story that ends with a burning question. And then the second part of the book is his effort to answer that question. So what's his story? Well, as I said, he was in a concentration camp. But one day, he was taken out of that concentration camp and taken to a hospital. He had no idea what was going on, but he was taken to this hospital and into the room of a Nazi guard who was dying. And this Nazi guard knew that what he had done in his life against the Jews was a problem. And he wanted to confess his sin to a Jew. And so he had arranged to have Simon come to his bedside. They did not know each other. And so he begged Simon, "Please, can you forgive me?" And Simon in that moment was wrestling with issues of justice and mercy. Do I talk or do I remain silent? And Simon said, "I listen to his plea and I stayed silent." He left the hospital room. But that moment was riveted in his mind. And he wondered and he wondered and he wondered, did I do the right thing? Did I make the right decision? And so years later, he sends out a letter to religious, civil leaders and asks them, did I make a mistake? Or was it right for me to remain silent? So the rest of the book are the answers from 53 leaders to that question. Of those 53, there's one that has stuck in my mind over the years. It was the response of Abraham Heschel, a Jewish leader, rabbi, teacher. What did Heschel say? Heschel told a story. His response was a story. And this was the story. He said, the rabbi of Brisk was beloved by his people. But he had been on a long journey. But it was finally time for him to return to the town of Brisk. And he was coming back on a train. The rabbi walked into the train compartment and there was a group of salesmen there, businessmen. And they were playing a game of cards and the rabbi quietly took his seat and soon was immersed in his reading and his studies. But there was something about his presence and about his aloofness that bothered these men. And so they started saying, "Hey, you, come join our game, play with us." And the rabbi politely refused. They continued to beg and finally said, "Sir, look, if you're not going to be civil and join us in our game, you really don't belong here in this compartment." He didn't respond, just continued to read. Finally, one of the salesmen had enough and he stood up and he grabbed the rabbi and he pushed him out of the compartment. Well, with time, they arrived at Brisk. The rabbi gets off and his people are there waiting for him, and they're cheering, and they're giving him hugs. They're so delighted to have the rabbi return. This also was the destination for the salesman. And he got off, and he sees this, and he grabs a passerby and says, who is that man?" "Oh," they said, "you don't know. That's the rabbi, our beloved rabbi." And the salesman was smitten by what he had done. And so when the rabbi was free for a moment, he came up to him and he said, "Sir," he said, "I had no idea who you were. Please, can you forgive me for the way I treated you on the train?" And the rabbi looked at him and he said, no, I'm sorry, I can't forgive you. Well, this tore the salesman up, and he couldn't sleep that night. And so the next day, he arranged to go to the home of the rabbi. And he came in and he said, sir, he said, I'm not a wealthy man, but I'll take all the money in my bank account and I'll give it to charity in your name. If you'll please just forgive me. And the rabbi said, no. And he was dismissed. The salesman said, well, what can I do? And he decided to go to the synagogue and talk to some of the people there about what was going on. And so he was telling them the story, and they said, well, that's not our rabbi. Our rabbi is so forgiving. He's so graceful. We don't understand. And the rabbi's son was there, and he said, I know my dad. He said, I can't believe that he wouldn't forgive you. But it's not appropriate for a Jewish son to challenge his father. So he had to delicately address the question with his dad. And they're talking, and he says, Dad, doesn't Jewish law require us to forgive someone who asks 2-3 times? Doesn't it require us to forgive? And his dad said, that's right, son, it does. He said, well, Dad, and he mentions the salesman's name. Well, why didn't you forgive him? And his dad, the beloved rabbi of Brisk, said, son, I can't forgive him because he didn't sin against me. He sinned against a no-name Jew in a train car. Let him go ask him for forgiveness. Now, I tell that story not because I necessarily agree or disagree with the position. I offer that to illustrate how powerful the story was in answering the question. It would be hard to refute that story merely in just giving some rational arguments. Something about, you see, out of all 53 responses, that's the one that I remember. Power of story. Well, Heschel was following the example of another Jewish rabbi, Jesus. Jesus used stories in many ways, many occasions, and I just want to quickly list a few. He used stories to explain difficult ideas in the parable of the laborers. He used stories to correct false and deeply rooted prejudice. And the story of the Good Samaritan, which we're going to look at in just a moment, is a great example of that. That's not the primary purpose of that story, but it clearly was one of the reasons that he used the story. Jesus used stories to keep opponents from understanding while illuminating the understanding of the people who genuinely wanted to follow him. Jesus used stories to reinforce a main point. He'd have something he really wanted to get across, and he would use a story just to open that up. He used stories to get past the barriers of argument. There were times in which if he would have just given a straightforward answer, it would have just opened up into a big argument. But instead, he gave a story which seemed to cut through that and really answer the situation. Jesus used stories to uncover evil intentions in his audience. Now, I know I don't have these up here for you to copy down. But we're going to go on because we have a long ways to go and only half an hour to get there. Let's take a look at one of those stories. And behold, a lawyer stood up to put him to the test, saying. Now, you may recognize that in this story, we have the Shema again. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. But this is a different occasion. How do we know? Remember the occasion we talked about on Tuesday? We had a seeker, a person who really wanted to know. And in that case, it was Jesus that quoted the Shema to him. In this case, Jesus gets the man to quote the Shema back to him. He says, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" Notice the question is different here. In the earlier time, it was, what's the most important thing to do in life? In this case, the person is saying, how do I get to live forever? It's a different question. Jesus says, and notice that in this case, instead of answering, Jesus asks a question back. Jesus says, what is written in the law? How do you read it? And he answered, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, mind, and your neighbor as yourself." And Jesus said to him, "Good answer. Do it." But he, desiring to justify himself, said to Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" Now, classic example here of where Jesus could have given a straightforward example, could have defined neighbor, could have said something like, your neighbor is anyone who's in need. But what does he do? A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. Now by chance, a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, he passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion, went to him, bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he set him on his own animal and brought him to an inn and took care of him. And the next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper, saying, take care of him, and whatever more you spend, I'll repay when I come back. We've heard this story, and we've heard this story, and we've heard this story. Imagine how powerful it would be if it was for the first time. See, it's a brilliant story that cuts right to the heart of the issue. And then Jesus asks another question. Which of these three do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers? Notice the shift in the question. The question was, who is my neighbor? And Jesus is now saying, are you a neighbor? Are you the kind of person that's a neighbor? The story gave context to just really cut through the issue. And the man said, the one who showed him mercy, Jesus said, go, do the same. Stories. Stories are one of the most powerful tools available to us as teachers for shaping loves. We've been giving a lot of theory, a lot of philosophy about what we ought to be doing, the why of what we're doing, and methodology and so on. Here's where we get really practical today, and this is an eminently practical session. You want to shape loves? Carefully choose your stories that you tell and you retell and you permeate your classroom with. If you have students whose loves trouble you, stories can be a gentle, compelling way to redirect those loves. Second, the Anabaptist tradition values story for passing on beliefs and values. We are part of a tradition that is convinced that story is a good way to communicate our beliefs and values. In fact, it's why the Martyr's Mirror was written. It was a collection of stories to try to communicate beliefs and values. It's why it was reprinted in colonial America, because the church was beginning to feel like our beliefs and values were being lost, and we needed some stories to tell again. But it's a tradition that maybe we're losing somewhat. And I would encourage us to pick up this tradition. Third, good stories. Good stories should permeate our teaching. We can use stories across the disciplines, not just in history class, not just in literature. There's place for stories in math and science and all the disciplines. I'm not planning to give you a lot of theory here in this session. Really, what I'd like to do is just kind of give some ideas about additional ways to incorporate story. Or maybe even more than that, just to inspire us to be collectors and users of stories. That's what this session is about. And part of this vision is to avoid twaddle. Twaddle is a word that Charlotte Mason gave us, a British educator of the 1800s. She recognized that not all books are created equal, that some are classics, some you just have to tell, you have to read. We need to be looking for those. So we glean for the classics. Glean is a word that means to collect gradually, bit by bit. And that's what it's going to take for us to be capable users of story. I like this quote from C.S. Lewis. He said, "It is certainly my opinion that a book worth reading only in childhood is not worth reading even then." And he points to the fact that good stories are good stories for children as well as adults. Let's look for those. Now, if we are going to be people whose classrooms are permeated by stories, we're going to have to become collectors. So I want to spend some time talking about collecting stories, and then maybe a bit of time on using the stories we collect. So, collecting stories, some general ideas here. It is vital that we have a system for recording, organizing, and retrieving stories. We don't remember that well. And so if we're going to all these stories we run across, and you're probably running across stories here this week, and there's a couple, maybe one or two, that you say, "I'd like to use that story." But you know, if you don't record it and you don't have a way to pull it back, you won't use it. Some people have asked me, "How is it that you remember so many stories?" And part of the reason is, there's two reasons. One is, I write stories down. I have long lists of stories. And secondly, I tell them. I find that if I tell a story twice, it's there. And I can pull it back up for other occasions. And so my family, you know, they just have to hear my stories because that's the way I lock it in. This may be electronic. That's what I tend to use now. I use PaperPort to scan stories in. I also, if it's a story that I need to type in or something like that, I have a document and a database system that I use for that. But I'm not here to tell you how to do it. I'm just saying you need to do it. You need to find a way that fits you for having stories, being able to find the ones that can be useful in any given time. It may also be paper-based, and that's perfectly fine as well. A filing system, even just a shelf where here are the stories that I use in my classroom. Here are the books that I use. A few ideas about acquiring books and stories. Yard sales, a thrift store is a great way to get twaddle. 95% of what you find at yard sales and thrift stores is really not useful. But there's some there. Also, internet sources of stories, and I'm just giving one. I'm pointing this out as a category. I could give you 20, 30 sites, but I'm just giving you one biggie here. Onlinebooks.library.upenn.edu has over 1 million books available that you can just pull up right there. All of these are out of copyright, so they're old, something beyond 70, 80, 100 years. But still, there's some really good stuff that you can pull from there. Use book sales. The booksalefinder.com lists book sales all over the United States. And this, I find that book sales really are a much better way to get some worthwhile books than thrift stores or yard sales even. Here's what you want to do. If you've never been to a used book sale, two pieces of advice. Number one, be sure you get there 15 minutes before it opens. A used book sale within the first 30 minutes, anything of real value goes. So you have to be there when it opens. Second thing I would say is in that 15 minutes, you want to redeem the time, go up. I know you can't butt in line, but what you're going to do is you're going to move to, if you didn't get there first or close to the first, you might have to walk up but introduce yourself to some of the people at the front of the line and ask them, where are the good used book sales in this area? Because those people at the front of the line, they do this, they know what they're doing, and they can tell you where to find the good ones. Those are some ideas on how to build a library on a shoestring. But the biggest piece of advice I have here is to look. Look for stories. Be a collector. If you stop by John Koblenz's office and ask to see some of his fossils, he has fossils all over the place. You know where he found them? I'm amazed. I'll be walking past, and he'll say, "Hey, Steve, come in here. Let me show you something." And he's found this new fossil. So where'd you find that? "Oh, it's just out here in the lane." Now, the reason he finds those fossils is because he's looking for them. The teachers who find stories are ones who are constantly looking. They're listening. When people are talking, "Hey, there's a story I could use." They're reading a book. "Ah, there's a story I could use." So we look. Now, what are the categories of stories that we can look for? And if you turn the handout over on the back, this is what I'm going to walk through with you. We should look for personal stories. Some of the best stories you can tell are ones from your own experience. Again, write them down. You'll forget your personal stories. When they're triggered, write them down. Hopefully, after a while, you can have this long list of personal stories that you have available to you. When I wrote that, one popped in my mind from my own life, and that was I was really into science as a fourth grader. I had a teacher that grew my love for science. Her name was Ms. Walker. And I really got into science fair. And one of the awards that I received for a science fair project I did was a two-day tour of the Savannah River site. Now, that's a really huge government facility. It's about the size of a county in Pennsylvania. The building isn't, but the land that they operate. They have three nuclear reactors on site there. The main point of that facility is to produce tritium for hydrogen bombs. Now, you have to understand, my heroes were scientists. And here I was, this farm boy, getting a chance to go and hang out for 2 days with real scientists. This was so exciting for me. And it was seventh grade when it happened. My dad drives me over, it's about an hour drive, drops me off, and the man who's going to take me around and give me tour for these 2 days is Regan Voigt, the head mechanical engineer there at Savannah River site. At lunchtime, we were talking, and Regan Voigt says, after we had talked about a variety of things, he says, "Steve," he says, what does your dad do?" I wasn't sure I wanted to tell him. He said, dad's a farmer." He says, "Really? He's a farmer?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You know what?" He said, "If I could do anything with my life, it would be to farm." But he said, "I don't know nearly enough to be a farmer." He said, "To be a farmer, you have to be a chemist, and you have to be an entomologist, and you have to be a soil agronomist, And he went down through this long list of things that I didn't know what he was talking about. I ended up rather proud of my father. Personal stories. Along with that, family stories. Ask your parents, your grandparents, what are those defining stories for us as a family? Those make great material for classrooms. Dig through written records of your family. You might be surprising what you'll find. There's not many people interested in the written records, but do it sometime. There's stories often embedded there. We have this really big, thick listing of heat walls, and that's what my mom is, a heat wall. And it's just full of names. And occasionally I'd look at those. But, you know, one day I discovered that at the front, there was about 10 pages of text. I decided to read it. And I found out that my 7th great-grandmother, his name was Magdalena Whalen, 7th great-grandmother grew up in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, but her family moved to Wilkes-Barre back in the mid-1700s. And that was right at the time of the French and Indian War. Her family, you may have heard of the Wyoming Massacre. Her family was involved in that. And some of her family was killed. She was able to somehow sneak down to the Susquehanna River, get into a canoe, lay flat because they said they were shooting at her, and actually float down the Susquehanna. Got off close to Harrisburg, walked back across country to Lancaster, where she was taken in by a Grable family. And several years later, David Heatwell, my 7th great-grandfather, discovered her. They were married, and 7 generations later, I showed up. But I love that story. It's a story embedded there in that text. Family stories. News stories. I told you one yesterday, the story of Rosario Butterfield. It's just one I got from the news. And then wound up reading a book about her because of that. Christianity Today often will publish short stories of what's happening in the Christian world today, and some of those are useful. Anecdotes. Now, what I'm referring to here are those short 1, 2, 3 paragraph stories that you run across in other books that you're reading. You may be reading an inspirational book or something like that, and there's this neat little story in there. And what's easy to do is to read it and then just keep going and say, that was a great story. But if you don't record it, you won't use it. Pull it out, copy it, do something so that you can retrieve it for later use. I remember years ago, probably 20, 30 years ago, reading a book on godly manhood. And there was this story in there about how that in Escorial, Spain, there is a there's this large palace, and the kind of the focal point of the palace is, or what's carrying a lot of the weight of the palace, is an arch. And the story is that when that arch, or when the building was being commissioned, the king, he did not like the architect's plan to have all the weight, or so much of the weight, on this arch. He said, there's no way it'll hold it. And so he said, we're going to build a tower, a pillar, from right in the center of that arch, from the ground right up to the middle. And that's going to hold it. The architect didn't like this because he was sure that his design was adequate. But, of course, that's the time when the will of the kings wins out. And so the tower, the pillar, was built. Years later, after the king died, the architect said, I have a secret. And he sent men up to the top of the tower to check. Because he was able to see that that tower was never completed. It was high enough up there, no one could quite tell. But there was a space between the bottom of the arch and the top of the pillar. I've used that story many times to help think about the beauty and the power of submission. Because that's precisely what an arch is two upright structures that have fallen together. That's how it's defined and joined together by a capstone. Story just pulled out of a book. Let's go on.
story collections, and I've given you several there. I'm going to just mention two here very quickly. Paul Harvey's Rest of the Story, there's probably 100 stories in here. They're historical stories that all have a twist at the end. Not all of these will be useful to you, but some could be. For example, story number 26 in this one is called A Truth of Grain, and it's the story of the Russian Mennonites, and bringing Turkey Red Wheat to America. This is how the story ends. What the story boils down to is this: if the Mennonites had not been driven out of Russia, the United States, instead of selling, might now be buying wheat from the Russians. And then Tony Campolo has pulled together a large collection of stories. Let me, again, just give you one. He says that he enjoys some of Kierkegaard's stories, and here's one he enjoys. Kierkegaard describes a town where only ducks live. Every Sunday, the ducks waddle out of their house and waddle down Main Street to their church. They waddle into the sanctuary, and they squat in their proper pews. The duck choir waddles in and takes its place. And the duck minister comes forward and opens the duck Bible. He reads to them, "Ducks, God has given you wings. With wings you can fly, with wings you can mount up and soar like eagles. No walls can confine you, no fences can hold you. You have wings, God has given you wings, and you can fly like birds." All the ducks shouted, "Amen," and they waddled home. Anabaptist stories. There's a number of stories from our own tradition that we need to be using and so on. And by the way, I should mention, I have not, for this presentation, gone into some places that are readily accessible to us, or at least not heavy on things. Say, some of the stuff that CAM has put out story-wise, or CLP, great resources. What I'm trying to do here is maybe give us some other options to add to that. And what I'd like to do here is just talk about a couple briefly. This one, it's not a great book in some ways, but it's just one that captured my imagination as a 7 and 8 year old. It's called The Tall Man. And these are an example of some of the pictures in it. My favorite picture was this one. I would sit and look at that and contemplate that. I'll give you the text. The soldiers took John Nays to a dungeon. They hung him with a heavy cord by his left thumb and his great right toe. The soldiers wanted John Nays to say, "I will be a soldier and personal bodyguard for the King of Prussia." But John Nays said, "No, I will not be a soldier and personal bodyguard for the King of Prussia." And the soldiers of the King of Prussia dragged John Nays to the king. The soldiers told the king, "John Nays says he will not be a soldier and bodyguard for the King of Prussia." The King of Prussia asked John Nays, a very tall man, "Why will you not be a soldier and personal bodyguard?" And John Nays said, "I cannot. Years ago, I became a preacher, a soldier for God and Jesus, my King and my Lord." "It is good," said the King of Prussia, giving John Nays a gold coin. "Go and serve your king." I understand that is a true story, and that some family still has that gold coin from the King of Prussia. Another one from our own traditions is from the Brethren tradition, Two Brothers, One Mission. And I think, actually, we are rapidly getting out of time, and so I will not read some of this story. Another book, Chariots in the Smoke. The first 5, 6, 7 chapters are set in the 1500s, the time of the Radical Reformation. It's a well-told story of that time period. It then also traces, it is a novel, by the way, but historically accurate, and it traces a Mennonite family through the 500 years. I just checked Amazon. This book is out of print. Checked Amazon, and they're selling new copies for $120. The bookstore is running a special right now on this. I forget what it is. Anybody know? I saw that they had it listed at special. It's $7 maybe or something like that. We bought out all the remaining stock of Chariots in the Smoke. That's why they're selling it for less than $130. Let's go on. So there's Anabaptist stories. While I'm here, let me also say this. Coals of Fire, I think, is a book that's underused in our circles. Some great, great stories in here. And along the same line, They Loved Their Enemies. Not all of these are usable, but also some similar kinds of stories to Coals of Fire. I really like Sharon's book on Annie Funk, and there's others listed here as well we could pull from. Next category collects biographies. You know, you sometimes just run across these delightful stories. Here's one, Small Man of Nanataki. The subtitle says, The True Story of a Japanese Who Risked His Life to Provide Comfort for His Enemies. This is not a book that you would read probably to your students. It's a little, it's not the told the best, but you could take this, read it yourself, condense it into a 10-minute story that could be very powerfully used in your classroom. So biographies, and I have to mention this one, Blood Brothers, Elias Shakur, biography of a priest, grew up in Palestine during the whole time of Israel becoming a nation. If you like the Brock and Bodie Taney stories about Jerusalem and so on, you have to read this book to get the other side. This man, Elias Shakur, who writes the book, has dedicated his life to bringing peace between the Palestinians and Israelis. It's just a remarkable story. There is episodic history, and by this I mean just snapshots from history that are told. And let me give, here's one that I ran across some time ago. It's called The Brigade. This is another book you probably would not read to your students, but very briefly, this is what it's about. At the end of World War II, there was a lot of Jews, of soldier Jews in Israel that were given the opportunity to go into Germany to help in the mop-up operation, just as a concession to them for all of the atrocities committed against the Jews. And that's what the brigade was. It was this group of Jews going back in. These men, they get back into Germany, and they're so frustrated with only being able just to help clean up stuff. And so what they do during the day is help clean up. At night, they become a tribunal. They go out looking for Nazis. And then they would take them out in the woods and have their own kangaroo court and kill them. And with time, these men begin to realize that they were becoming just like the people that they were killing. And there's a remarkable turnaround in a church one day. They're planning to go into a church and take the priest out because they found out that he was a Nazi. But instead, they go into the church, and they're having a service, and they decide just to sit and wait. And one of the girls, well, you'll have to read the story, but their lives radically shift as to what they do with that energy to correct the injustices of their past. Again, it's a story that needs to be told. Literature. In literature, there's just a wide variety. One of the things that literature can help us in our classrooms is to address prejudice. And so I've listed several here. Witch of Blackbird Pond would have to do with prejudice against some religious groups, like the Quakers. Dragon's Gate, prejudice against Chinese. 20 and 10, Jewish prejudice. To Kill a Mockingbird would be prejudice against blacks. I see Les Miserables on the list here as well. That's Melvin Lehman's favorite novel. It likes to tell that story. There are mission stories, and one that a lot of people are not familiar with is God Spoke Tibetan. If you don't have it, get it. This is a good one to read to students. Children's books. And I really had no idea how to judge the time here this morning. And you see, we're out of time. I was going to spend more time here because I'm convinced that older teachers don't use children's books enough. There are some wonderful, I know a good friend of mine is a high school history teacher, and he uses a fair amount of books like this to teach high school students history. And so Henry's Freedom Box, let's just at least touch into it a little bit. Henry Brown wasn't sure how old he was. Henry was a slave, and slaves weren't allowed to know their birthdays. Henry and his brothers and sisters worked in the big house where the master lived. Henry's master had been good to Henry and his family, but Henry's mother knew things could change. Do you see those leaves blowing in the wind? They're torn from the trees like slave children are torn from their families. Just very well written. One morning, the master called for Henry and his mother. They climbed the wide staircase. The master lay in bed with only his head above the quilt. He was very ill. He beckoned them to come closer. Some slaves were freed by their owners. Henry's heart beat fast. Maybe his master would set him free. But the master said, "You're a good worker, Henry. I'm giving you to my son. You must obey him and never tell a lie." Henry nodded, but he didn't say thank you. That would have been a lie. I'll give you one more picture from the book, and it's later on. True story. A story of Ruby Bridges should also be used in our American history classes to talk about civil rights, and I wish we could take the time to enjoy that story together. Faith the Cow, another children's story that tells the beginning of Heifer Project. In fact, maybe that's where we're going to have to end today. We'll just dip into this a little bit. This is a story of faith. Faith was a young Guernsey cow, a heifer. Faith was a special Guernsey heifer. She had a job to do. Faith was a heifer with a mission. Dan West loved peace. Dan West hated war. Dan West was ordered to serve in the Army, but when he was told the officer he wouldn't carry a gun and he couldn't kill, the Army sent Dan West home. Dan West knew there was a better way to settle disagreements, and the rest of the book is the creative way that Dan West decided to help people all over the world. Stories. Maybe we can finish up some of this tomorrow, but for now, Brother Howard.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.